See, that was me. I was trying to turn on my microphone, and I knocked him out a few moments ago. But thank you, Dr. LaHaye. It's an honor to be here for my first time, and it's an honor to be with Dr. LaHaye at any time that he invites me to do something. And Dr. Ice and Johnny, thank you so much. What a blessing to be here tonight. I'm very grateful, and I'm interested in talking tonight on the topic Dr. LaHaye asked me to, which is considering the prophecies of Ezekiel 38 and 39 in light of current geopolitical trends. But I want to be clear to something that you probably all know, but I'd like to just say it on the record, and that is, I am not a seminary-trained theologian. I am a failed political consultant. And that's an important distinction. I've helped a lot of U.S. and Israeli leaders lose their elections. That's sort of my that was sort of my calling for a number of years. Lynn and I married, and somebody's got to do it, exactly. And that was apparently with me. Bill Bennett, the former education secretary, hired me to work on a education reform initiative in California in 1993, I think it was, called Prop 174, was a school choice campaign. It was winning 60-40 when I arrived, and it lost 70-30. And that was sort of the beginning. A couple of years later, Steve Forbes hired me as a senior advisor on his 1996 Republican primary bid. He had just won Arizona, Delaware. He was actually leading in the delegate count, hired me. He was out of the race within 2 weeks. For some reason, he kept me on, and I was able to help him lose the second campaign in 2000. You laugh. I was on Pat Buchanan's TV show on MSNBC around that time, and it was canceled the next day. I'm not making this up, people. I wish I was. So I started my own little consulting firm, and I got hired by Natan Sharansky, who was the Deputy Prime Minister of Israel, and within a couple months of that, he got so frustrated with politics, he just retired altogether, at which point Bibi Netanyahu hired me on a small American team of advisors to complement his much larger Israeli team. But it was a team, it was supposedly, this is the fall of 2000, to be his comeback campaign team. Now, it's 8 years later, and if you're tracking Israeli politics, you know he has not yet come back. I was with him in his office a couple months ago in Jerusalem, spent about an hour together talking about just about everything, but I noted as I left that he had not asked me to work for him again. And while he's ahead in the polls right now, I think that's probably better, that I just stay out of the way. And so that really was my career, from 1990 when I got into Washington through the end of 2000, was pretty much failure. And so what I was asking of the Lord is, really, is this really what what you put me on the planet to do? I've learned a lot. I've had a tremendous time working for these men, all of whom I admire deeply. But there's a point at which you think, who's the next person to hire me? That's not a career that you can last on for a long time. Although I know people like Bob Beckel lost 49 states for Walter Mondale, and he's still a talking head on television. So apparently, if you're going to fail in Washington, fail big. And then, you can go on consulting and giving your views on everything for pretty much forever. So, but in the early, basically January 2001, I was feeling quite low. Because I had gone to Washington as a eager young man to try to make a difference. This was not the difference I was looking at. And I was feeling quite depressed. And I said, Lord, you got to help me. Use me for something, right? But I'm like, I'm the one Jewish guy that didn't get the financial gene, So I'm not a stockbroker. I'm not an accountant. A name like Rosenberg, I should be a doctor. I should be a lawyer, at least a chiropractor, an acupuncture or something, but nothing. So that was a problem. And, the thing is, I didn't really have any other qualifications to do anything else. Writing was what I had been trained to do, but I was writing speeches people wouldn't listen to, op-eds people didn't really care about. So for me, in January 2001, I was coming to the Lord basically saying, look, these are my loaves and fishes. I don't really have a lot to offer you, Lord, but I have a heart that wants to honor you, and I don't think you're done with me yet, and this is it. This is what I got. If you wouldn't mind taking this and blessing it, breaking it perhaps, and using it and multiplying it in some way to feed people, I want to just give myself to you. I think he had used that political career not just to teach me a lot and help me to see the world through the eyes of Steve Forbes on economics or Netanyahu and Sharansky on radical Islam, Bennett on education and cultural issues, but I think he'd done a lot to wring out ambition. There's still more to be done. And to wring out a sense that politics was the answer. Now, it's true that we need to be engaged in the political process, and I don't think that ever goes away, to be salt and light in our culture. But for me, it was time to go through political detox. Get out, get clean, move on with my life. And so I pulled. Now, my wife and I, Lynn and I, have four boys, Caleb, Jacob, Jonah, and Noah. And they're 14, 12, 10, and 4. So we live in Washington. That's, you know, that's a congressional cycle. And then 2000, 2002 were quite traumatic, but we, you know, then 2004, Noah came along. Now you say, well, why didn't you have a Noah? Well, you know, just being honest, Jesus said in Matthew 24 that he wasn't coming back again until the days of Noah. So we thought, you know, if we're holding him back in any way, well, so we have Noah. He's been on 3 missions trips this year, Brazil, Israel, and Turkey. So, you know, we're trying to raise up some a new generation. But really, so at the time, in January 2001, we had 3, Caleb, Jacob, and Jonah. So I pulled them together with Lynn one night, and I said, here's the deal. Daddy is getting out of politics. We're getting out, we're getting clean, we're going cold turkey. And here's the plan. So they liked that idea. Because they said, will you be home more? I said, yes, I will be home probably much, much more. But here's the thing I'm thinking about, I'm praying about. All my life I wanted to write novels and screenplays. So, here's the plan. Daddy wants to write a Tom Clancy-esque novel. Grab people's attention, pull them in, and raise the spiritual, evangelistic temperature throughout the book, and hopefully, you know, and maybe 3/4 of the book, way through the book, when hopefully someone can't put it down, then I want one of the characters to share the gospel with another character. So they liked that idea. So I said, now, there's just 2 problems with this scenario. Number one, I've never written a novel. I don't know how to write a novel. I don't even have time to read novels. I've never taken a class on writing novels. So that's going to be a problem. And they looked at me and thinking, yeah, that might be a problem. And then I said, but there's a second problem. That is, I don't really have a story. So those being the 2, you know, fairly central elements of writing a novel, publishing a book, you need the story and the capability to write it. So I said, here's what we're going to do. And now they're looking at me like, okay. So I said, they said, maybe this is why you've lost all those elections. No. My kids weren't quite old enough to realize that. Now they do. But what they said was, what I said to them was, here's the thing. Every night we're going to pray this verse of Scripture as a family, as we tuck you guys in. Jeremiah 33, verse 3, where the Lord says, call to me, and I will answer you, and I will show you great and mighty things that you do not know. I said, that is the perfect verse for Daddy. I don't know how to write a novel. I don't have a story. But if this is not just one more of Daddy's cockamamie ideas, of which I have warehouses full of them, believe me, but if this sense is from the Lord, the Lord's going to guide us, and so we're going to have to follow him, but we're going to have to beg him for mercy to get out of one system, the political system, and get into writing this type of political thriller with the evangelistic element woven in. So that's what we did. We started praying every night. Now, what came out of that was me thinking, okay, the story that most, the what-if scenario, I think every good political thriller needs to start with a what-if scenario that's credible, that's interesting, that's compelling, where the stakes are high. And for me, the one most compelling future event that I had ever studied was Ezekiel 38 and 39. Because my wife was working for Concern Women for America as Beverly LeHay's convention coordinator. So every fall, we would go to a convention site in Washington for a women's conference. Now, I didn't have anything to do with these conferences, but Dr. LeHay was there. So neither of us having anything to do at a women's conference, we just sat around and talked about Bible prophecy all the time. And that was fabulous. Now, he gave me this copy of this book, The Coming Peace in the Middle East, this treatise on Ezekiel 38 and 39. And while I had great respect for Dr. LeHay, I thought, now, Dr. LeHay, really? Russia? I mean, the Russia is collapsing before our eyes. This was 92, 93. But the Soviet Union has collapsed in front of our eyes. 1 million Jews are pouring out of the former Soviet Union, going to Israel. The bear is not, the bear is dead. It's not coming back, right? He said, well, that's the way it looks now. I said, all right, well, if you say so. And Russia and Iran, I mean, come on. These two countries have hated each other for time immemorial. I mean, for much of the late 19th century and much of half of the 20th century, Russia occupied parts of northern Iran. And when the Ayatollah Khomeini came to power in 1979, he started hating the United States and Israel. Israel had been an ally of Iran until 1979. Not a strategic ally, but Iran was selling oil to Israel, was co-training fighter pilots with Israel, but not in 1979. But did the Ayatollah go rushing to the arms of Moscow? Not exactly. Moscow came rushing to the arms of Kabul, Afghanistan. And the Ayatollah Khomeini railed against the godless communists from the north. So the events just didn't seem like they had ever set themselves up for the events of Ezekiel 38 and 39. And they, from my perspective in the early 1990s, it seemed like, yeah, I believe that's true, but that's probably 500 or 1,000 years off. I mean, something way, way down yonder. Well, now pick up the story. The fall of 2000, on September 11th, 2000, I met Natan Sharansky for the first time at a hotel in New York City around 9 o'clock in the morning. This is the year before. So I had been hired to help him on a number of different projects, and one of them at that moment was to take him around Washington and New York City on a media tour, as he was explaining why he had just resigned from Ehud Barak's administration in Israel, because Barak had just gone to Camp David, or was about to give the store away, in Sharansky's view, to Yasser Arafat. So I got hired to help Sharansky make the case why that was a bad move at the wrong time, offering the wrong deal to the wrong guy. So I agreed with that, so I was happy to help him. So we got to know each other that first morning, September 11th, 2000. Now, over the course of the next few days, I took him all over Washington and New York. And when we were in Washington, we got on the Delta shuttle back to New York at the end of the tour, and we were sitting on a Delta shuttle flight back up to LaGuardia, and I said to him, Mr. Sharansky, when you were in the Gulag, in the Soviet prison for 9 years, did you ever imagine yourself as the deputy prime minister of the state of Israel? And of course, he just laughed and said, I just was hoping to see my wife one day. I never imagined that I would have a political role, certainly of that type of prominence. He said, but that was not the most interesting thing that's happened to me in my life. He said, the most interesting thing, a bizarre thing that had ever happened to me, he said, was when I was, from his voice, when I was the Minister of Industry and Trade under Prime Minister Netanyahu. And Bibi calls me into his office one day and he says to me, Natan, I want you to go to Moscow. Sharansky, I don't want to go to Moscow. Been to Moscow, done Moscow, not going back to Moscow. Okay? And he says, no, you're the exact right person to go. Here's the dossier. I want you to go and sit down with then FSB chief Vladimir Putin. And I want you to explain to Putin this intelligence that we've gathered of Russian nuclear technology moving into the hands of radical Islamic and Arab regimes. And what we are most concerned about, I want you to tell him, Bibi said, is the danger of Russian nuclear technology falling into the hands of either the Iraqis, or even worse in his view at that time, were the Iranians. And so Sharansky was describing this scenario, and as I'm sitting there on this flight, I'm thinking, first of all, That's a horrifying scenario. Russian nukes or Russian nuclear technology in the hands of Iran or Iraq. Second, I thought, this is very cool, sitting here next to this man as he's giving me insights into Netanyahu's perspective and Putin's perspective. Third, I thought, if I ever do write a novel in the future, that I may want to come back to that. That what if scenario. What if Iran, what if Iraq got nuclear weapons with Russian help? But then over the next several days, I came home and I thought, did he just tell me that the Prime Minister of Israel is concerned about a Russian-Iranian military alliance, a nuclear alliance between those two countries? That's what he just told me. And I went to my garage, and I have to admit, Dr. LaHaye's book was buried in the garage because I wasn't going to be needing that for 500 years. But I went through my garage quite feverishly trying to find that book again to say, isn't that what 8 years ago or so Dr. LaHaye was saying? Watch for Russia and Iran to begin to have interests that align into a military alliance. And I found that book, by God's grace, and I began to read it, and I began to study the scriptures again, and I thought, and so up to January now, so that was in September, now up to January 2001, we've just come back from an inaugural ball of the incoming Bush administration, which I had, you know, been deputy campaign manager against, so I wasn't waiting by the phone, you know, to get the job offer. So I thought, as my kids and I were praying about what, you know, I thought, maybe this is it. What if Dr. LaHaye were right? What, you know, I mean, that sounded crazy to me at the time, not to you. But I was thinking, I don't mean literally crazy. I mean, is it possible, I thought, that we may be in a moment where it's not that far off where this Russian-Iranian relationship accelerates into an alliance? And if that were the case, a novel about the prophecy wouldn't seem that far off to people. It might seem quite realistic. And if I were to bury my religious beliefs deep into the book, then people might not think I was a lunatic. Because in Washington, you know, the things that we talk about here, the things that you're talking about, that's not what we talk about in D.C. I mean, we talk about other crazy things, but not that, right? So I thought, I want to thread that needle fairly carefully, if possible, to hold the attention of the people I want to reach for a while until they finally go, all right, I see where he's going. But I thought, let's see how this could be done. So that's where the idea came. But I had a problem. And my problem was January 2001, I think, finally, all right, I'll write the Ezekiel option. What if this Ezekiel 38 and 39 thing plays out in my lifetime? Not that I knew that it would. Not that I was predicting that it would. But just what if? Okay. But the problem I had was two countries are not listed in Ezekiel 38 that are fairly significant enemies historically of Israel. One is Egypt. I mean, you know, going back to the time that Charlton Heston was staring down Yul Brynner, Egypt and Israel have been at war with each other. But now, since 1979, since the Camp David Accords, we are in a period of time where we are in the first window in human history where Israel and Egypt are not at war with each other. I don't know how long that will last, I was thinking at that time, and still think that today. But we're in that window. That's very interesting, because Egypt is not mentioned in Ezekiel 38 and 39. Could have been, isn't. Okay, well, that's interesting. Okay, so I don't have to worry about Egypt. But the other country not mentioned in Ezekiel 38 and 39 is Iraq. Now, of course, Iraq is not a name that's ever mentioned in the Bible, but by Babylon or Babel or Babylonia or Shinar or Mesopotamia, take your pick, none of it's in there. So I had two options. First of all, that didn't make sense because Iraq in January 2001 didn't have a peace treaty with Israel. So if I was going to write a scenario, a fictional scenario about how this might play out in my lifetime, the challenge I would have is, what do I do with Saddam Hussein? Well, if you know, it's fiction, so maybe I should just put him into the equation of Ezekiel 38. I'll just make it up. So I'm making everything else up, so why don't we just add that into the scriptures? I thought that might not be wise. So that didn't seem biblical to me. So I thought, well, then I got to figure out something. I can't What am I supposed to do, right? The novel's building and all this tension's building, and then suddenly, what, Saddam Hussein's at Club Med that weekend? He misses the chance to gas the Jews with the Russians and the Iranians? I mean, come on. So I thought, you know, the only way to write this thing is I'm going to have to back up and write a different novel first. I have to write a novel that gets rid of Saddam Hussein. Well, how do you get rid of Saddam Hussein? I didn't know. And I was a failed political consultant, not a successful strategist, right? So I'm sitting there in my room praying Jeremiah 33:3, thinking, Lord, come on. I have to have something to say, something to write. So I thought through all the different scenarios. Saddam could die of natural causes. But he was a fairly young man at the time, and that didn't seem like an interesting way to start a book anyway. There could be a coup or an assassination. Well, that was possible, but Saddam had built his whole life around preventing that possibility, right? So it could happen. It could have happened, but I thought it's unlikely. The only way I imagined at that time of Saddam Hussein not being in power, because the theory was Iraq is clearly a country in the last days. When Ezekiel says this prophecy is going to happen, it's going to be the last days country. So it's going to be there, but someone, either Saddam or someone like Saddam, is not going to be there, apparently. Otherwise, they would jump into the fray. So I said, okay, there's only one way that I really think is plausible, and that's a foreign invasion. Well, there's only two countries on the face of the planet at that time that I thought were capable of pulling off such an invasion. Russia was one of them, but they were arming Saddam Hussein. Didn't seem likely they were going to go after a client state. And the other one, of course, was the United States. But I thought, it's January 2001, George W. Bush has just been elected. Who in their right mind is going to believe that George W. Bush, who's talking about tax cuts, health care reform, social security reform, education reform, is going to invade Iraq? So I thought, all right, what would be the scenario that my fictional president, I'm not going to write about President Bush, I'll make up a fictional character, but how is that going to happen? The only thing I could think of was that what if radical Islamic terrorists were to unleash an attack so horrifying inside the United States that a sitting American president would have to unleash a war against radical Islamic terror cells and then be drawn to the states that sponsor, encourage, have supported them historically, and their eye would go instantly to Iraq. And I added a weapons of mass destruction threat into that, thinking that makes sense. That would boost the urgency of going into Iraq. And so the first page of The Last Jihad opened by putting you inside the cockpit of a jet plane that had been hijacked by radical Islamic terrorists and was coming in on a kamikaze attack mission into an American city. Now, it happened to be Denver, not New York or Washington. But that attack leads in the story to my fictional American president in a showdown, in a war, a fictional war, with Saddam Hussein over the linkage between terrorism and weapons of mass destruction. Now, I began that in January of 01. I was finishing it on the morning of September 11th, 2001. In our townhouse, where we were living at the time, 15 minutes away from Washington Dulles Airport, where at that moment, Flight 77 was being hijacked, turned around, flown over our house, and into the Pentagon. Now, I can't tell you that at that moment I was thinking, oh my gosh, my novel's coming true. That is not what I was thinking. I was thinking what you were thinking. It was shock, and it was horror, and it was anger, and it was fear that what's next? Will there be a 9/12, a 9/13, a 9/14, a 9/15? My city was under attack in Washington, the city where my father grew up, he grew up in Brooklyn. That city was under attack. I had just been to the top of the World Trade Center a few weeks earlier, and the world was changing so rapidly in front of me, and I thought the last thing that I can do is send a manuscript to a New York City-based publisher, thinking, what if this happened? No one was interested in that story. So I put that in a drawer, and I said to my wife, the Lord has bigger fish to fry than this right now. We are in a very disorienting moment. But let's just, between ourselves, note this is going to be one more failure of taking 9 months and all of our savings to write something that's, you know, useless. But maybe it gave me some experience to write something else. Now, we were sitting in January of 2002 watching the State of the Union address. And we watched President Bush say that the next threat we may have to face is the threat of Saddam Hussein because of the linkage between terrorism and his previous use of weapons of mass destruction against the Kurds. And I looked at my wife, and she looked at me as though we were sitting in an episode of The Twilight Zone, thinking, kamikaze attack, the president saying we may be going to war with Iraq. I got a call from my agent the next day saying, do you work for the CIA? I said, no. He said, sure, sure. That's what you'd have to say if you did work for the CIA, and you just couldn't tell me. And I said, well, I don't. He said, well, I think the world has just changed again. I think now most thriller writers are sitting thinking, how do I write a novel that envisions a new world where the Soviet Union isn't the threat, but radical Islam is? But your book is done. I think we should take it to a publisher now. And so we did. And when the novel came out in November of 2002, I mean, no, believe me, nobody but my wife and children and the Lahays, God bless them, had ever heard of Joel Rosenberg. And they certainly had never heard of The Last Jihad. But when it came out, Sean Hannity got excited about it, and Rush Limbaugh called me one day. I had been a ghostwriter for Rush in the mid-1990s, and he called me one day and said, Rosenberg, I didn't know you could write. You know, I said, thanks a lot, Rush. He said, no, I didn't know you could write fiction. And I didn't have the heart to tell him that all my liberal friends thought I was writing fiction when I was writing for him. But I thought, you know, that was not the time or the place to really go into that. So he said, I want you on my show tomorrow. And this, over the course of the next 60 days, I was on 160 radio and television programs, almost all of which would say things like, how could you possibly have known this type of scenario was coming? And I said, of course, I didn't know. I mean, there's differences between what I wrote. They said, but conceptually, you sense this was coming. And I said, and they said, well, what do you think is going to happen next? And I would talk about what I thought. And they'd say, okay, now that's interesting, but isn't your name Rosenberg? And I said, yes. Well, isn't that Jewish? And I said, yes. And they said, but you've got these characters at the end of your book. They're all talking about Jesus, aren't they? I said, well, yes. Well, what are you, a born again? An evangelical? Like they would say it like it was the most creepy thing that they'd ever heard of, right? I said, yes, I believe that Jesus is the Messiah. Yes. They said, well, how is that possible? How can you be Jewish and believe in Jesus? I was on one program in my hometown of Rochester, New York, a guy named Brother Wees. And he's like, dude, first of all, are you a Hebe? I said, what? He said, are you a Hebrew? I said, as a national hot dog? Are you Jewish? He said, yeah, yes, I'm Jewish. I'm Jewish on my father's side. I was raised Orthodox, escaped out of Russia. Gentile, my mother said, Rosenberg, that seems Jewish to me. Well, he goes, I'm a Jew too, a Hebrew. And he said, but you believe in Jesus? I said, yes, I do. And you're writing about that in this novel? Yes, I am. Well, how is that possible? How can you be Jewish and believe in Jesus? I said, well, Mr. Wees, it's an interesting story, but I don't think you have time for me to talk about it on your show right now. He goes, oh, wait a minute, I'll keep you on. He goes, it's one thing to have a guy who writes novels that come true on my show. It's another thing to meet a Jew who believes in Jesus. I never even heard of that. So I told him how it works. And this happened again and again and again for the next 60 days. God, in his total mercy, gave me the opportunity to begin talking about my faith in Jesus Christ with over 20 million people in less than 60 days. Jeremiah 33:3, call to me, the Lord says, and I will answer you. And I will show you something great and mighty that you do not know. And I think, and I'm not sure if the plane attack and the Iraq thing was the main thing, as it was, bring your loaves and fishes to me and let me do something with that. I can do that. You think you're a zero? Let me put a one on the front of that. And the Lord began to use this. And so it led from one book to another. Now, so the next book, I'm not going to go through the type of detail I just did, but you should know the next book was called The Last Days. And the first chapter, I knock off Arafat. In fact, well, actually the way the book begins is that the first page puts you inside a U.S. diplomatic convoy driving into Gaza as part of a peace process, when suddenly that convoy is attacked by terrorists. Now, 6 days before the last days hit bookstores, a U.S. diplomatic convoy driving into Gaza was attacked by terrorists. This is when U.S. News and World Report did a story describing me as a modern Nostradamus. So now I'm on hundreds of radio shows saying I'm not Nostradamus. You know, I'm not a psychic. I'm not a clairvoyant. I don't call Miss Cleo in the middle of the night to get my plot ideas. You understand what I'm saying? But they said, in this article, it said, "Watch out, Arafat. Rosenberg offs you on page 24. So, now, I wrote that because I had gotten rid of Saddam in the first book, which cleared a little bit of the path into Ezekiel 38. But I couldn't write the Ezekiel option as the second book because Yasser Arafat was unleashing suicide bombers daily into Israel. And I thought, Israel needs to be living securely in the land. And they're not going to be secure with Saddam, and they're certainly not going to be secure with Yasser Arafat on the planet. Researching the Ezekiel option, and I got a phone call from my publicist saying, like a stack of interview requests of people remembered you being on the show last year, and I'm saying, now Arafat's dead, what do you think is going to happen next? And so I did those shows from Istanbul, and then they said, now your name's Rosenberg, right? So the Lord was giving me a gospel opportunity in the midst of all that. So eventually I wrote the Ezekiel option. And page 358 of that novel, where a dictator rises to power in Russia and then forms an alliance with Iran, which is feverishly trying to build, buy, or steal nuclear weapons. And then they form this alliance with a group of other countries, and then they try to attack Israel. And then the whole scenario of Ezekiel 38 and 39 plays out in that novel. Page 358, one of my fictional Islamic characters says, "We're going to wipe Israel off the map." Now, 5 months after the book was published, our old friend in Iran, President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, I want you to say that 5 times quickly with me. No, you can just call him Ahmed Genocide, because he said, 5 months after this book came out, he said, "We will wipe Israel off the map." But you have to understand, he was not the president of Iran when I wrote the Ezekiel option. I wrote it in 04. He became the president of Iran on June 24th, 2005, the very day the Ezekiel option was published. So that's why Tyndale asked me to write Epicenter. I said, write a nonfiction book this time and walk people through the thinking here. And walk people through the biblical basis for where you're going and where how this prophecy plays out in the future. Because you've got an audience now that is curious. You know, when you're on these radio shows, they're not really talking to you about the novel. They don't really care. I mean, to be honest, this is not Dickens. You know, this is not Shakespeare or Steinbeck. I mean, let's not kid ourselves. The Washington Post called The Last Jihad an act of terrorism against the reader's brain. So, I don't want you to think, oh, if I haven't read these books, this is just going to be the greatest thing I've ever... No. Read Dr. Leahy's books. But what's happening here is current events are drawing people to these books. And I want to just mention a few tonight, and then we'll take some questions if you've got some. Because it's current events. It's the trajectory of geopolitical forces currently that's got people curious. It's not my prose. God bless my publisher and my publicist. We're getting a book out there, but that is not what's happening. What's happening is Russia is forming an alliance with Iran and with Libya and with Sudan and with Algeria and Libya and Turkey and Syria and Lebanon and these countries. And because those things are happening and they're so outside of people's expectations of what the future of the Middle East will be. I remember in 1990 when I got to Washington, somebody just wrote a book called The End of History. The Soviet Union was collapsing. This was it. We're done with conflict in the world. I mean, we weren't quite done, apparently. But we look at what's happening. Like, for example, the scriptures make clear in Ezekiel 38 that a dictator will rise to power in Russia. Now, I was on, one of these times I was on Glenn Beck, actually earlier this year, I was his producer called me and said, Glenn would like you on for an entire week. I said, a week on CNN? What does he want me to say? He said, well, every night he wants to talk about events in the Middle East, starting with Russia, Iran, all these things you're talking about, from the what you call the third lens of Bible prophecy. Meaning, my point in Epicenter is, if you only look at the world through political lenses or through economic lenses, you can't really see in three dimensions. Only if you look at the world through the third lens of Scripture can things begin to be clear. And he said, Glenn wants you to come on and talk about major geopolitical events in the Middle East, in Russia, each night from a biblical perspective. And then on the last night of the week, we'll do an hour, just you and him, called Honest Questions About the End of Days. I said, who is this really? CNN? For a week? So I did that. Now, one of the first nights, I think the first or second night that I was on, one of his first questions was, Joel, is Vladimir Putin Gog? I just about fell out of my chair. You know, I wasn't sitting having dinner with Tim LaHaye. This wasn't Pat Robertson on the 700 Club. This was CNN, people. They're asking me if Putin was Gog. When did a commentator on television know the name of Gog? I was a Gog just thinking about the question. And I was a little floored. I mean, this was a little more specific than I expected on CNN. So I said, well, I was a little, I want to be cautious. I don't know if Vladimir Putin is Gog. I said, look, I don't know. Let's say he's Gog-esque. Okay? Because we have somebody in Moscow right now who could be. I want to be clear. I'm looking in the camera here and I'm saying, I don't know if Vladimir Putin is Gog. And I will tell you that because I'm not a seminary-trained theologian, and even if I was, I think I would still say this. I think, for me, I'll just speak for myself, I need to be able to say as often as possible, or often as necessary, on television, on radio, in speeches, in sermons, I don't know. There's a lot we don't know because Ezekiel doesn't tell us. So I feel I have to be cautious. And certainly, I don't want to do anything that would bring discredit on the Lord. And so if somebody asked me on national television if a particular political leader is a forerunner to the Antichrist, aside from libel issues, I want to be able to eat my next salad. You know what I'm saying? You don't know what I'm saying. You know, when Vladimir Putin has these enemies and, sometimes they put radioactive bug spray on the people's salad and the guy dies, right? You don't want to take on Vladimir Putin unless you have to. And so right now, I don't know if that's him, but he's Gog-esque, right? And on April 25th, 2005, he gave a speech in which it was a major speech in which he said the number one, the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the 20th century was the collapse of the Soviet Union. Now, he and I look at the 20th century differently. I don't see the collapse of the evil empire as the worst thing that happened. I think it's one of the best. I look at perhaps the Holocaust as right ranking right up there. World War II, World War I, Cambodia, the Pol Pot, the killing fields, Rwanda. I mean, there's a whole long list before the collapse of the evil empire. But that speech gave a window into Vladimir Putin's soul. And it told us something. It told us that he's a czar wannabe. In the classic tradition, my family, Orthodox Jews on my father's side, they escaped out of Russia under the czars. And if you're living in 1907 in anti-Semitic fascist czarist Russia, as an Orthodox Jew, you got pretty much two options. You can fiddle on the roof. We can try to get out. And not a lot of people were able to get out. Some were. My family was able to. And therefore, I look at Putin and I see czar. And when I give a speech like that, I get a sense, this is a guy who sees Russia collapsing, imploding, and he wants to, in a classic czarist fashion, rebuild this empire, expand it. But he's got a problem. He can't go west in terms of territorial expansion. Why? Because NATO is moving east. He can't go east because China is a nuclear power. So he took over the North Pole. June 2007, he laid claim to the North Pole. I'm not making this up, right? He did. But where's his real strategic advantage? South. It's the only place he can go. So what is he doing? He's selling billions and billions of dollars worth of weapon systems to the countries that want them most. Iran, Sudan, Algeria, Libya. you know, the list goes on and on. He's building a strategic alliance called the in Central Asia, called the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. The trend lines of what has happened in just the last few years of Vladimir Putin feel very much ripped off the pages of Ezekiel 38 and 39. December 2nd, 2005, Russia signed a $1 billion arms deal with Iran. This is 2 months after Ahmadinejad gives the famous speech saying he will wipe Israel off the map, and in that same speech saying, imagine a world without the United States. Is this possible, he asked, this conference of terrorists in Tehran, is this possible, a world without America and a world without Zionism? And then he answered his own question by saying, it is when our holy hatred strikes like a wave. So he gives that speech in October of 2005, and 2 months later, Vladimir Putin signs a $1 billion arms deal with him. Continues to build the Bushehr reactor, selling billions of dollars worth of nuclear technology as well. July 07 signs a $1 billion deal with Iran, selling 250 long-range strategic bombers to Iran. October 16th, 2007, I was invited that fall, the next day, to speak at the Pentagon. And the topic I was speaking on was Mahmoud Ahmadinejad and his eschatology and evangelical perspective. And the point was to talk about how Ahmadinejad believed the end of the world is imminent, and the way to hasten the coming of the Islamic Messiah, known as the Mahdi, is to annihilate two countries, Israel, the little Satan in his view, and the United States, the great Satan in his view. And these Pentagon leaders asked me to come in and just walk through the eschatology of the leadership of Iran. Now, how often is the word eschatology used in D.C.? Right? I had to look it up. No. I was a little tentative going in to talk about that and how, because of this eschatology, Ahmadinejad's belief that he'd been chosen for this moment to annihilate these countries, that's why he's building these relationships with Russia, with China, and North Korea, because they're nuclear powers. And you need weapons of mass destruction to accomplish genocidal, apocalyptic, messianic objectives. So I was going to the Pentagon and I thought, these guys are fighting real wars, hot wars. I don't want some kid walking in telling them, oh, and the Bible tells you this. I was a little intimidated. But the day I got there, the front page headline was that Vladimir Putin had just arrived the day before in Tehran, the first Russian president in human history to have meetings in Tehran that didn't happened to just be there. In 1943, Stalin went, but that was, Iran was his front porch, his back porch. He was meeting with Churchill and Roosevelt. He wasn't meeting with the Iranian leadership. This was to build a strategic alliance. And this was a front page, New York Times, Washington Post, USA Today. Everybody in the Pentagon was talking about it that morning. I'm not that bright. My political career shows this. But if you believe the Bible is true, and you look at the events that are happening in the world, and you say, isn't this remotely possible that we're getting close? You look at these events, and you think, wow. Even unbelievers, even people at the highest ranking levels of our government, Islamic governments, the Israeli government, are starting to wonder about these events. I'd be happy to answer some questions about what other events are happening, but I wanted to give you some context from where I'm coming from, and I want to say this caution. I say it in every speech, on every interview, every time, everywhere I go, I say this. Just because Russia and Iran are now forming a military strategic alliance that has never happened in the 2,500 years since Ezekiel wrote the prophecy, just because that's happening, and these other events are happening that are so consistent with the prophecy, does not mean that those prophecies are going to come true in our lifetime, much less soon. God in his sovereignty could kick the can up the road 10, 20, 50, or more years away. So I try to be clear with people. We don't know yet. There's a lot that has to happen before it gets clear that this is really it, for sure. But we can't rule out the possibility that this is approaching. And in part, because of Ezekiel 36 and 37. These are the famous chapters, of course, about the rebirth of Israel in the last days, Jews pouring back into the Holy Land after centuries of exile, rebuilding the ancient ruins, making the deserts bloom. These things have happened in our lifetime and are still happening. And if Ezekiel 36 and 37 have come true to the extent that they have, I say, isn't it remotely possible that Ezekiel 38 and 39 could come true in our lifetime as well? And if it does, then writing novels about it, or even nonfiction books, can't be all that we do. Not for me and my wife. Because real people are going to suffer. Judgment is going to come upon the nations that surround Israel. And why is it taking so long to get to that point of these prophecies coming true? Because the Lord wants these people to come to Christ, or at least have a chance to hear the gospel. And we need to do everything we possibly can to mobilize the church, to get engaged in the spiritual conflict, to love the Muslim people and share the gospel with them, because some of them face a judgment that we have never seen since the Ten Commandments. And of course, we never saw it. But it could happen in our lifetime. And if it does, I don't want to stand before Jesus one day and have him say, you knew this storm was coming. You were sitting there in the National Weather Service radar office and you saw Katrina coming and you decided not to tell anyone about it? You know, NBC News once profiled Robert Ricks, the National Weather Service forecaster who had issued the almost apocalyptic forecast right before Katrina hit, saying how bad it was going to be. And very few people believed him because it just sounds unbelievable. But after it all had happened, and he'd been proven, actually, that he was understating it in a sense, effectively, Brian Williams interviewed him, and he said, what were you thinking? He said, and Rick said, I knew I couldn't stop that storm, but I could see it. I knew it was coming. I knew the type of devastation it was going to cause, and the only thing I could do was warn people to get to safety. And I believe that's what Ezekiel was doing. I believe that's what Dr. LaHaye and you all are doing. And in a small way, that's what I'm trying to do. A storm is coming, and we can't stop it. But we can warn people about it, and God in His grace has given us quite a bit of advanced intelligence of what's coming. We don't know it all, but we know enough to tell people, you need safety. You need a personal relationship with Jesus Christ, because nothing else will protect you when that storm hits. God bless you for your work. Thank you for letting me be a part of it and for what I've learned from you all. And I just thank you for this opportunity to share a little bit tonight. God bless you.
Okay, we're going to take questions from the audience. And Daniel will come around and you can ask a question via this microphone. And so as you're getting ready to raise your hand to ask your question, I will ask the first question.
Okay.
What do you think is in store for the Obama administration?
Well, you recall that I had mentioned going through political detox. So part of me, needs to be very careful in what I say, because I'm in my post-partisan phase. And it doesn't mean I don't have strong beliefs, but let me say a few things. First of all, the Apostle Peter tells us to... Oh, thank you. The Apostle Peter tells us to fear God and honor the King. And the Apostle Paul tells us in 1 Timothy to pray for kings and all in authority. Why? So that we can have quiet lives as much as possible, and that we can have the freedom, the ability to share the gospel, because that's what God desires, that all men come to know Him. And so I'm getting a lot of feedback from my email alerts right now in which I'm talking about the concerns I have about the new administration, that I don't think they understand the Iranian threat. The president-elect, when he was running, said that Iran was a tiny country and not a serious threat. But then the next day, he gave a prepared speech saying it was a grave threat and we had to do everything we could to stop them. Which one should we believe? I mean, I certainly need to be a hopeful person, so I'd like to believe that he's got people around him increasingly that are telling him, you cannot believe, much less say, that Iran is a tiny country and not a threat. But I'm concerned that that's where his heart is. The unscripted moment was telling us something. But at the same time, I think we have to be very careful. As evangelicals, and particularly those of us who talk about prophecy, I mean, people think we're nuts anyway, and I think it's very important that we honor, not necessarily support in terms of their policies, but honor our leaders even if we deeply, deeply disagree with them. In part because this is what the Lord tells us to do, and we don't want to stand before Jesus in heaven and say, look, Daniel worked for Nebuchadnezzar. Joseph worked for the Pharaoh. Why couldn't you not have honored the President of the United States? What exactly was the problem there? So that's one issue. But the second issue is because if you're going to move people on their positions, you need to have a respectful dialogue, and I think we need to help. We need to speak both the words and in the tone that would help the potential that this administration or staffers or, you know, the new Secretary of State or whomever would begin to understand that the world differently than they currently do. But we need to be realistic that they currently don't understand this. Just yesterday Sunday on Meet the Press, the president-elect said that he was trying to ratchet up things with Iran and that we need to offer more carrots and sticks. Now, I have to ask you, what type of carrots can you offer a man who believes it's his God-given mission in life to annihilate Judeo-Christian civilization in order to usher in his Messiah? There's no carrots that would entice me to stop preaching the gospel of Jesus Christ in the second coming. You can give me as many cafe lattes as you want and take me to Brussels or New York or Vienna or wherever you want to have the conversation, but you're not going to persuade me to stop preaching the gospel and preparing the way for Jesus' return. How would we really expect that Ahmadinejad, a true believer in evil, but nevertheless, he truly believes it? What carrot do you offer a man like this? Remember, this is a guy who thinks that he was chosen to be the president because of this moment. He has a PhD in traffic management. I don't know how bad traffic is in Tehran, but it must be hellish to get a PhD in this. But when you go from that to a mayor, and then when you enter the race, as I'll describe it, I got a new book coming out next year, Inside the Revolution, the 30 years of this Iranian Revolution. But when I describe this, when he entered the race for the presidency in the spring of 2005, he was at 2.8% in the polls. Now, when you win, you might think that you've been chosen by Allah to usher in the Mahdi. We got to pray for his soul that God changes his heart. he's running again in the summer of 2009, Tommy. So maybe I'll offer my services. Yes, sir.
Hey, thank you, Joel. That has been very interesting, and I've been following your web blog for years. And I think I read the last.
And you came anyway. You're very kind.
Came anyway. Maybe the most recent one, you said you didn't think Israel was going to take any action against Iran, and then I think I read in the news today that it's still being talked about. But with all the focus on Iran, I'm wondering if you have any insights, because there, unless I'm missing something in Ezekiel 38 and 39, there's another country that I don't see mentioned, and that's Syria.
Right.
So I'm wondering if you have any insights about that and how that might figure in. I know Isaiah, I think, mentions that Damascus ceases to be a city.
Right, so, right.
I thought maybe you might be able to offer some insights.
Those are all excellent questions. Let me try to be concise. I had just written on the weblog that while there have been discussions since the summer that Israel might use this window between the American elections and the inauguration of the next president to launch preemptive airstrikes against the Iranian nuclear facilities, that having just been in Israel a week and a half ago or so, I don't see any evidence that that's about to happen. Still could, but today they just finished up the Likud primaries. February 10th are the Israeli elections. The country is not on a war footing. There were a couple, and part of that is because Ehud Olmert is the prime minister and lost the second Lebanon war, effectively. And there's not a lot of confidence in the country that he would be able to lead forward into the biggest war that Israel would ever face in its 60 years to date. The Israeli government was also waiting to see who would win. If McCain won, they would wait longer, thinking maybe McCain will solve our problems. They're now recalculating, because with Obama, he's talking about, again, just reiterating it on Meet the Press on Sunday, direct negotiations at the highest possible level without preconditions. So, they're saying maybe we need... So the Jerusalem Post just reported a couple days ago, front page, that the IDF is preparing first strike options against Iran without needing U.S. Or calculating in that they wouldn't even be informing the United States ahead of time. So the country's recalculating. But there's another date that they're watching for, and that's June for these elections. If Ahmadinejad is voted out and somebody semi-reasonable comes in, if the supreme leader Ayatollah Khamenei dies, which is not unlikely because he's very ill, then the whole world could change over there, and that could give us a lot of time and a lot of peace relative to the region. So they're watching things right now. Now, in terms of Syria, that's right. Now, I had mentioned casually, but I should be more precise about Syria and Lebanon. As you know from Ezekiel 38 and 39, the coalition comes from the north. And it comes against the mountains of Israel. So, what does that mean? Well, the most prominent mountains of Israel are in the north, along the Lebanon border and the Golan Heights, which the Olmert government's trying to give away in these last few days. But I don't think they're going to be able to pull that off in the next month and a half. But still, those are the most prominent mountains. So we have to expect, based on the evidence here, that if we're taking this literally, that this invasion is going to come through Syria and Lebanon. Not exclusively. The country will most likely be surrounded in some way. But now, because Syria and Lebanon are not mentioned precisely, maybe that means they're not willing participants. Maybe they're overrun. If it were to happen in the next, in the near future, or the next few years, or what have you, and I'm not predicting that it will, but if it did, it wouldn't be hard to imagine Syria and Lebanon being active participants. But we don't know that they will be because they're not mentioned so precisely. Damascus, that's a great question. The prophecies about Damascus not being a city anymore aren't very detailed, and they're not necessarily directly related to Ezekiel 38. It could happen in the aftermath, the judgment of Ezekiel 38 and 39, right? The fire could fall down it's going to fall down from heaven, and a massive earthquake, and Damascus could be obliterated as a city during that. But I would offer one other very brief scenario, and that is something could happen between now and Ezekiel 38. Damascus could be destroyed. It could be destroyed supernaturally. It could be destroyed because weapons of mass destruction are parked there and go off for some reason. It could happen because the Israelis launch an airstrike against a facility in Damascus, as they did against a nuclear reactor that had not gone hot yet, built by the North Koreans or with their help a year and a half ago or so. But what if they hit a facility that has weapons they didn't even realize were there? It could take out the entire city. If that were to happen, it could be so cataclysmic that it shuts the terrorists down for a while, and the whole region gets quiet enough to trigger the Israel living securely in the land. I don't know. I'm getting used to saying that. I don't know, and therefore I'm very cautious about giving some sort of order to that, because the scriptures don't give us any order.
It hasn't been too many years ago that Zhirinovsky was more Gog-esque than even Putin. Yeah. He was far more nationalistic. Is the general consensus that he is out permanently, or is he still in the wings?
Mad Vlad. Vladimir Zhirinovsky was on the cover of Time in 1994 as the rising czar. I interviewed his chief strategist for my nonfiction book, Epicenter, and that was one of the most chilling meetings I have ever had. This guy sat down in the Hotel National across from the Kremlin with a couple thugs in the corners to guard in the doors, and he literally walked through Vladimir Zhirinovsky's plan. He said that Zhirinovsky would run in 2012 and would probably be ready to take over power at that time, and he walked through all the countries that Zhirinovsky, that Russia would take over under Zhirinovsky's leadership. Sitting there as I brought my father with me. I said, "Dad, you want to go back to the old country and meet some fascists?" He said, "Sure." So we went over there together, and we're sitting there. He's a first-generation American family escaped out of from people like this. And I, you know, by God's grace, they had escaped. So we were sitting there. We just thought, you're on the record, right? I mean, I'm writing all this down right in front of you. You know that I'm writing a book. He didn't care. I don't know. But in many ways, I think Vladimir Putin has essentially stolen Zhirinovsky's thunder, because he's far more fascist and effective than Zhirinovsky ever was. And I think that, you know, just a couple days ago, Putin said that he was starting to hint that he might stay in power and move back into the presidency in 2009. Then he gave a press conference saying, well, maybe not till 2012, he'll look at it again. The point is, I don't think you need a Zhirinovsky to get a Gog. But, you know, maybe, but who knows? That's why we don't want, just like with the Antichrist, we wouldn't want to be pegging specific leaders with that role, because that's very dangerous. We got enough to do to persuade people the basic concepts of the scripture than getting ourselves into naming people. And I think the same thing with Putin. Now, if it's all moving in motion and it's clear, then we'll name somebody when it's appropriate. But I don't think we need Zhirinovsky to emerge to get a Gog, but we certainly know that he's in the wings should he be needed.